This is program C1142. We are looking at my Living in the Last Days Prophecy seminar notes as we work our way through the book of Revelation. And so if you do not have a copy of that, I would encourage you to go to intotheword.net, look in the PDF resource section, and get a copy for yourself. It will be very helpful given some of the things that I will give to you today. Some of the suggestions that I make to you are completely unique to myself, and you need to be able to see some of the written supporting information that I provide in the notes. For those of you that don't have internet, you can go ahead and give me a call. My number on my cell phone is 574-850-1327. Since I do not answer numbers that are not yet in my call log, go ahead and leave a number and your request to get a hard copy of the notes, and I'll get back with you. So I'm looking at Revelation chapter 11 and Revelation chapter 16 today, as well as several Old Testament passages that are going to support what we talk about. We're on page 90 of the notes, where I've got all of these different scriptures laid out in a comparison format. And I hope that that helps you to kind of absorb all this together. We've been looking at how God's final wrath is poured out against those who'd have voluntarily accepted the mark of the beast. We've looked at wrath events 1 through 6. There's only one more left. Wrath event number 7, which we're going to discover is in connection with the second coming of Jesus. It's the last trumpet and the last bowl to be poured out, and that's when Jesus shows up in the sky. But we had given the suggestion that the two witnesses who show up at the beginning of the final 3.5 years are the ones orchestrating all these wrath events, meaning they announce what's about to occur, much in the same way that Moses and Aaron did that during the 10 plagues of Egypt when God was bringing the judgment of himself upon the pagans of Egypt that were holding his people in fealty. So we need now to return to our story about the two witnesses. You might remember that they had been tasked to do their work during 1,260 days. That's 10 days short of a 3.5 year period on any Jewish calendar of the ancient world. So as the final wrath events are occurring, the witnesses' time is about to run out. And so we need to go back to Revelation chapter 11, verse number 7, to see what happens when that occurs. I remind you of my own suggestion that these men are likely Enoch and Elijah. And my reason for suggesting that is because these are the only two men in all of Bible history past that did not die, but rather were taken away by God supernaturally. And I think they were taken away to this time period so that they could serve him during the 3.5 year period and then lay down their lives in the way that we're about to read. So I think this is the rest of the story for both those gentlemen. Revelation chapter 11, verse 7. When they, meaning the two witnesses, finished their testimony, the beast rising up out of the abyss did battle with them, overcame them, and killed them. So they were untouchable, immortal for all practical purposes during the 1,260 days. But once that time had passed and their job was done, God allowed them to be killed. Now, I think there are some other things that take place in connection with this, as recorded in the Old Testament book of Zechariah. The last three chapters of Zechariah, chapters 12, 13, and 14, are clearly tied to the second coming of Jesus Christ and the final wrath of God. And I think that at the beginning of chapter 14, we actually see what will happen on the day that the two witnesses die. The two witnesses have been protecting a group of people, someone that I've suggested are messianic believers. It's the faithful Israel, the woman that we met at the beginning of chapter 12. They've been protecting her at the city of Jerusalem, probably at the Temple Mount, maybe the entire old city. But right there is where they will die. We know that. It specifies it here in just a moment in Revelation chapter 11. But I think that what happens is described in Zechariah 14. Let me read to you from there. "Behold, a day is coming from the Lord when the spoil taken from you will be divided among you. For I will gather all the nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city will be captured, the houses plundered, the women ravished, and half of the city exiled, but the rest of the people will not be cut off from the city." Now, we'll explain what happens to them in just a moment. But this seems to reference an overrunning of the city of Jerusalem by enemy forces. And so I would suggest to you, and again, that's all it is, a suggestion. We're speculating here based on different passages of Scripture. My suggestion to you is that God will allow Jerusalem to fall into the invading army of the beast leader that has surrounded the city of Jerusalem because of all the horrible wrath events that have happened against them at the direction of the two witnesses. They hate these guys so much that they want them annihilated. So they surround the city of Jerusalem. They force their way into the city. They capture it. They kill the two witnesses. They plunder the place. They rape the women. They exile those that they think can be useful slaves elsewhere in their kingdom. And then there is a small number that will escape in a little bit, and we'll talk about them. So I think that's how it will play out on day 1,261 of the final 3.5 years. Verse number 8 of Revelation chapter 11. "Their corpses were upon the street of the great city that is spiritually called Sodom in Egypt, where also their master was crucified." So that last line tells us beyond a shadow of a doubt, we're talking about Jerusalem, because Jesus was crucified at Jerusalem. Jeremiah 23:14, by the way, specifically likens sinful Jerusalem to Sodom. Now, we don't have a place where it is likened to Egypt necessarily, except where you count this passage in Revelation chapter 11. So Jerusalem is overwhelmed by the forces of the beast leader and the two witnesses killed. Verse number 9. "The corpses were seen by peoples, tribes, languages, and nations for 3.5 days. Their corpses were not allowed to be placed in a tomb, and those living on the earth celebrated over them, were merry, and gave gifts to one another, since these two prophets had tortured those living on the earth." That last line is where I get the idea that the two witnesses have orchestrated all of these wrath events. So once they're dead, they won't allow their bodies to be buried. Instead, they put them on display. It's possible that they will have some sort of international broadcast, you know, a 24/7 feed to show everybody the two guys that have caused us all this grief and cost us a third of our people most recently in one day. They're dead, and you can see that they're dead. You can see their horribly mutilated bodies here laying down in the streets of Jerusalem. And then everybody's going to celebrate. Happy Dead Prophets Day, you know, that sort of thing. They'll give gifts to each other. They'll be high-fiving, all of that, because they think they've done it. And then verse 11. After 3.5 days, the spirit of life from God entered them, and they stood on their feet, and great fear fell on those who were watching them. And don't you know, that's exactly what's going to happen. If their dead bodies, mutilated, as I suggest, bodies, suddenly, boom, pop back to life, and they're in their perfect form, that is going to scare a lot of people. Because these guys are back to life again. And then it says, verse 12, they heard a great voice from heaven saying to them, "Come up here." And they ascended into heaven in a cloud, and their enemies watched them. So these two guys get to launch away from their death site, their resurrection site, just like Jesus launched up from the Mount of Olives on the day that he left planet Earth. So they go up into the sky. Everybody sees this happen. Again, use our imaginations. If they've got this 24/7 feed, everybody in the beast kingdom is going to see this happen. And it's going to freak them out, if I can put it that way. And of course, it's God who is wrapping everything up. Now, you can just take the days here. If they were killed on day 1,261, then that means they're going to be resurrected 3.5 days later. That would be 1, 2, 3, 4. So they are going to be resurrected on 1,264, which means there is exactly 1 week left of the 3.5 years. So we are 1 week from Jesus. 1 week from the second coming of the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. Verse 13, in that hour, meaning the hour of their resurrection and ascension, in that hour a great earthquake occurred and a tenth of the city fell. So a tenth of the city of Jerusalem is destroyed by this great earthquake. 7,000 men were killed in the earthquake, and the rest were terrified and gave glory to the God of heaven. So 7,000 casualties, a tenth of the city destroyed, and this great earthquake occurs. Now, back in our Zechariah 14 passage, there is something that would certainly cause such an earthquake right there at Jerusalem. And I want to read to you, starting at verse number 4. It says, let's start at verse 3, because first we have, in the first two verses, we have the invasion of the city of Jerusalem, and then we have Jesus, the Lord's counterstrike, cited. Verse 3, then the Lord, Yahweh, will go forth and fight against those nations as he fights in a day of battle. In that day his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, which is in front of Jerusalem on the east. So here we have the reminder that when Jesus comes back, he will be coming back to the exact spot that he left from. The Mount of Olives. You remember in Acts chapter 1, the ascension took place from the Mount of Olives. And the disciples, the apostles, were standing there just gaping up into the sky. And the angels came and said, "What are you doing just staring up into the sky?" He will be back in the same way he left. And so that's why we're all anticipating his return to the Mount of Olives. And when he stands on earth again, it will be there at the Mount of Olives. Now, the language in Zechariah chapter 14, verse 4, I think could be a little bit misleading. Not intentionally misleading. It is that we might jump to some conclusions. I certainly have in the past, based on our English here. And that is, we assume that the Mount of Olives doesn't split until Jesus lands on it. But the wording here in Hebrew allows for the fact that it has already split by the time he stands there. And I'm going to suggest to you that it does split on the day that the two witnesses rise from the dead and ascend into the sky, and there's that great earthquake where a tenth of Jerusalem collapses and the 7,000 casualty figure occurs. Because this is what it says in Zechariah 14:4. The Mount of Olives will be split in its middle from east to west by a very large valley, so that half of the mountain will move toward the north, the other half toward the south. And you will flee by the mountain, or my mountain, you will flee by the valley of my mountain, for the valley of the mountains will reach Azael. Now, Azael, nobody knows where it's at. Apparently, it's on the east side of the Mount of Olives, heading down toward the Dead Sea. So you will flee by this new valley, for the valley of the mountains will reach to Azel. Yes, you will flee just as you fled before the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah. So we have the prediction here that there will be this earthquake, that the Mount of Olives will split. Some of it will slide north. Probably we're talking about Mount Scopus area. It's where Hebrew University is currently located. And some of it will slide south toward where the Palestinian village of Silwa is located. The exact site that I'm thinking about right now where the split will occur seems to be where all of these graves are located on the Mount of Olives right now. If you go with me this next June, you will be shocked at how huge this cemetery is. It's just full of all these ground-level tombstone toppings to graves. And there is no vegetation there, nothing. It's just a big blank space, just immediately east of the Temple Mount. So I think that that's exactly where this new valley is going to go. And it's going to be through that valley that the survivors of the invasion will run. They will escape. Do you remember that from up in verse number 2 of Zechariah 14? The rest of the people will not be cut off from the city, meaning that they will survive. Apparently, they're the ones in verse 5 that will flee by the valley of my mountains, all the way down into the Dead Sea area. My guess then is that they will turn southward and they will be trying to make their way as far down the Great Gore, that is the great deep Dead Sea Valley area, that they can. And I think that they will be caught up with by the beast leaders' military forces somewhere south of the Dead Sea, in the ancient territory of Edom. And I'll talk more about that in a later episode, a little bit later time, when we talk about Jesus coming. All right, so this valley, this new valley that is bracketed by the two parts of the split Mount of Olives, is where I think the Battle of Armageddon will take place. Now, I know a lot of you have been told it takes place about 50, almost 60 miles away up to the north at the ancient city of Megiddo. And I've been to Megiddo a couple of times now. We're going to go there again in June, Lord willing, when we go on our trip. But I no longer think that that's the word that's intended in John's word, Har Megiddo. And let me tell you about my own little journey of discovery here. And as far as I can tell, this is totally unique to me. You can reject it for that purpose, but I'd rather you just listen as I explain why I am confident about this now. This is what we know. The word that appears in just a little bit in Revelation chapter 16:16, Har Megiddon. Har is Hebrew for mountain. And Megiddon, with the little N on the end, is the Hebrew word for splitting or for cutting. The original site of Megiddo might have gotten its name because it's located near the opening of a cut or a pass through Mount Carmel. But this is the journey of discovery. I was reading through Zechariah chapter 12. I was trying to do some translation work, study work, and I was in verse number 11, and I was puzzled by the fact that in my English version, it says there that there's going to be mourning of Hadad-Rimmon in the plain of Megiddo. But since I do some of my work in the Greek Septuagint, that is the Greek translation from about three centuries before Jesus and the apostles, that translation says the place of the cutting, the plain of the cutting. And I'm like, what? How come they're not going with the proper noun Megiddo? And then I got to looking at the Hebrew much closer. And I noticed that while every other place in the Old Testament where the city of Megiddo is mentioned, they're all spelled exactly the same. This place in Zechariah chapter 12, verse 11, has a final noon on the end of the word, the equivalent to our letter N. And that what that seems to indicate to the translators of the Septuagint was, this is not the proper noun of the city, this is a participle, splitting or cutting. And suddenly, things opened up for me. Oh my goodness, we know of a mountain later in the book of Zechariah, just a couple of chapters over, that gets split or cut in half, and it forms a new valley. And Har Megiddon, the valley of cutting or the valley of splitting, would be the perfect new name for that site. And so that is the reason that I now believe and teach that the final battle will take place exactly where Jesus is coming back to as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And that all makes perfect sense because the armies of the beast, those that had taken the mark, those that are following the false prophet, those who are being used as puppets by the dragon, by Satan, they are already at the site of Jerusalem when all this stuff happens. And they know, based on everything that's been set up to this point, this is where Jesus will invade to. And that's where they barricade. So I want to read to Revelation from Revelation 16:13 now. This is the parallel about what happens after the sixth wrath event. And John reports, I saw three unclean spirits like frogs come out of the mouth of the dragon, the mouth of the beast, and the mouth of the false prophet. So these are false words from the three wicked leaders. The dragon is Satan, the beast is the final world ruler, and the false prophet is the final religious supporter of that ruler. And I've suggested, and will do again, the last pope, who is a betrayer pope. Verse number 14, for these are the demonic spirits that perform signs which go out into the kings of the entire inhabited earth to gather them together to the battle of the great day of God Sabaoth. So they are being used to get all of the final people that have taken the mark of the beast into one spot on planet Earth. And that spot is going to be where Jesus is coming back to. Verse 16, behold, I come like a thief, meaning suddenly. How blessed is the one who is watching and keeps his clothing so that he may not walk naked and his shame be seen. The idea that you don't fall asleep and get yourself in trouble. You need to stay on watch because Jesus is coming back. And then Zechariah chapter 12 gives this little bit of insight. They will look to me whom they pierced. They will mourn for him as one mourns for the only son and weep for him who weeps for the firstborn. So Jesus is coming back. The one that had been pierced the first time he was here, but resurrected from the dead, ascended on high, he's now coming again as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And everybody is gathering to stop him. And Revelation 16:16 says, he gathered them together in the place called in Hebrew, Har Magidon, or Mount Cutting, or Split Mountain. And when we pick up the story tomorrow, I'll remind you of some of this, but we will see Jesus coming back to planet Earth to claim those who are his own and put down the great rebellion.